Welcome to Fast Asleep. Thanks for spending time with us. Hey, another Thanksgiving is just ahead of us now. And, well, we've turned to author Sarah Orne Jewett once again for a seasonal story. You can check back to episode 133 for her very beautiful A White Heron. Now, let's talk about the start of her career. Ms. Jewett was just 19 years old when her very first story was published. She's known for her tales of really country life. The stories are simple, yet so full of details. And now let's talk about the end of her writing career. She was just 59 years old, and it was in the year 1909 when she suffered a very serious stroke that actually left her paralyzed. And sadly, another stroke that same year ended her life. But on a happier note, we found a little bit of some interesting information for you. We found out that the recent film The Lighthouse, starring Willem Dafoe and the very handsome Robert Pattinson, actually was based on a character that Sarah Orne Jewett wrote. The Dafoe role was actually one of her characters. Now, there's a little bit more to this episode today. Because we are nearing the Thanksgiving holiday, we're also bringing you an article from the Smithsonian Magazine entitled Wampanoag Indian Thanksgiving. We think you may enjoy this perspective. Are you ready? Right now, get yourself comfortable and, well, tuck in, everybody, for Sarah Orne Jewett's The Night Before Thanksgiving. There was a sad heart in the low-storied, dark, little house that stood humbly by the roadside under some tall elms. Small as her house was, old Mrs. Robb found it too large for herself alone. She only needed the kitchen and a tiny bedroom that led out of it. And there still remained the best room and a bedroom with the low garret overhead. Now, there had been a time after she was left alone when Mrs. Robb could help those who were poorer than herself. Oh, she was strong enough not only to do a woman's work inside her house, but almost a man's work outside in her piece of garden ground. At last, sickness and age had come hand in hand, those two relentless enemies of the poor, and together they had wasted her strength and substance. Why, she had always been looked up to by her neighbors as being independent. But now, well, she was left lame-footed and lame-handed, with a debt to carry and her bare land and the house ill-provisioned to stand the siege of time. For a while, she managed to get on. But at last, it began to be whispered about that there was no use for anyone so proud. It was easier for the whole town to care for her than for a few neighbors. And Mrs. Robb had better go to the poorhouse before winter and be done with it. Oh, at this terrible suggestion, her brave heart seemed to stand still. The people whom she cared for most happened to be poor, and, well, she could no longer go into their households to make herself of use. The very elms overhead seemed to say, "Oh, no," as they groaned in the late autumn winds. And there was something appealing, even to the strange passerby, in the look of that little gray house with Mrs. Robb's pale, worried face at the window. Someone has said that anniversaries are days to make other people happy in, but sometimes when they come, they seem to be full of shadows, and the power of giving joy to others, that inalienable right which ought to lighten the saddest heart, the most indifferent sympathy, sometimes even this seems to be withdrawn. So poor old Mary Ann Robb sat at her window on the afternoon before Thanksgiving and felt herself poor and sorrowful indeed. Across the frozen road, she looked eastward over a great stretch of cold meadowland, brown and windswept and crossed by icy ditches. It seemed to her as if before this, in all the troubles that she had known and carried, well, there had always been some hope to hold, as if she had never looked poverty full in the face and seen its cold and pitiless look before. She looked anxiously down the road with a horrible shrinking and dread at the thought of being asked, out of pity, to join in some Thanksgiving feast. But there was nobody coming with gifts in hand. Once she had been full of love for such days, whether at home or abroad. But something chilled her very heart now. Her nearest neighbor had been foremost of those who wished her to go to the town farm. And he had said more than once that it was the only sensible thing. But John Mander was waiting impatiently to get her tiny farm into his own hands. He had advanced some money upon it in her extremity and pretended that there was still a debt after he cleared her wood lot to pay himself back. Oh, he would plow over the graves in the field corner and fell the great elms. And he waited now like a spider for his poor prey. Oh, he often reproached her for being too generous to worthless people in the past and coming to be a charge to others now. Oh, if she could only die in her own home and not suffer the pain of homelessness and dependence. It was just at sunset as she looked out hopelessly across the gray fields, and there was a sudden gleam of light far away on the low hills beyond. The clouds opened in the west and let the sun shine through. One lovely gleam shot swift as an arrow and brightened a far cold hillside right where it fell. And at the same moment, a sudden gleam of hope brightened the winter landscape of her heart. Oh, there was Johnny Harris, said Mary Ann Robb softly. Oh, He was a soldier's son, left an orphan and distressed. Old John Mander scolded, but I couldn't see the poor boy in want. I kept him that year after he got hurt, spite of what anybody said, and he helped me what little he could. He said I was the only mother he had ever had. "I'm going out west, Mother Rob," says he. "I shan't come back till I get rich." And then he'd look at me and laugh. Oh, so pleasant and boyish. He wasn't one that liked to write. I don't think he was doing very well when I heard. There. That's most 4 years ago now. I always thought if he got sick or anything, I should have a good home for him to come back to. Oh, and there's poor Ezra Blake, the deaf one, too. Oh, he won't have any place to welcome him. The light faded out of doors, and again Mrs. Robb's troubles stood before her. Yet it was not so dark as it had been in her sad heart. She still sat by the window, but hoping now, in spite of herself, instead of fearing. And a curious feeling of nearness and expectancy made her feel, well, not so much light-hearted as light-headed. "I feel just as if something was gonna happen," she said. "Poor Johnny Harris. Perhaps he's just thinking of me. If he's alive." It was dark now, out of doors, and there were tiny clicks against the window. It was beginning to snow, and the great elms creaked in the rising wind overhead. A dead limb of one of the old trees had fallen that autumn, and, well, poor firewood as it might be, it was Mrs. Robb's own firewood, and she had burnt it, most thankfully. There was only a small armful left, but at least she could have the luxury of a fire. She had a feeling that this was her last night at home, and, well, with strange recklessness, she began to fill the stove, as she used to do in better days. "Ah, it'll get me good and warm," she said, still talking to herself as lonely people do. "And I'll go to bed early. It's coming on to storm." The snow clicked faster and faster against the window, and she sat alone, thinking in the dark. "Yes, there's lots of folks I love," she said once. "They'd be sorry I ain't got nobody to come and no supper the night afore Thanksgiving. I'm dreadful glad they don't know." And she drew a little nearer to the fire and laid her head back, oh, drowsily, in the old rocking chair. It seemed only a moment before there was a loud knocking, and somebody lifted the latch of the door. The fire shone bright through the front of the stove and made a little light in the room, but Marianne Robb waked up frightened and bewildered. "Who's there?" she called, as she found her crutch and went to the door. She was only conscious of that one great fear. Oh, They've come to take me to the poorhouse," she said, and she burst into tears. And there was a tall man, not John Mander, who seemed to fill the narrow doorway. "Come, let me in," he said gaily. "It's a cold night. You didn't expect me, did you, Mother Rob?"
"Oh, oh dear me, what is it?"
she faltered, stepping back as he came right in. She dropped her crutch.
"Be I dreamin'? I was a-dreamin' about... Oh, yes, there. Oh, what was I sayin'? It ain't true, no. I've made some kind of a mistake, yes, and this was the man who kept the poorhouse, and... Yeah, well,
she would go, without complaint. They might have given her notice, but she must not fret. "Sit down, sir," she said, turning toward him with touching patience. "You'll have to give me a little time. If I'd been notified, I wouldn't have kept you waiting a minute in this stormy night." But it was not the keeper of the poorhouse. The man by the door took one step forward and put his arm round her and kissed her.
"What are you talking about?" said John Harris. "You ain't gonna make me feel like a stranger. Now, I've come all the way from Dakota to spend Thanksgiving. There's all sorts of things out here in the wagon, and a man to help me get 'em in.
Oh, now, why,
don't cry so, Mother Rob. I thought you'd have a great laugh if I come and surprised you. Don't you remember? I always said I should come."
It was John Harris, indeed. The poor soul could say nothing. She felt now as if her heart was going to break with joy. He left her in the rocking chair and came and went in his old boyish way, bringing in the store of gifts and provisions. It was better than any dream. He laughed and talked and went out to send away the man to bring a wagon full of wood from John Mander's, and came in himself laden with pieces of the nearest fence, just to keep the fire going in the meantime. They must cook the beef steak for supper right away. They must find the pound of tea among all the other bundles. They must get good fires started in both the cold bedrooms. Why, Mother Rob didn't seem to be ready for company from out west. The great cheerful fellow hurried about the tiny house, and the little old woman limped after him, forgetting everything, but not hospitality. Had not she a house for John to come to? Were not her old chairs and tables in their places still? Oh, and he remembered everything and kissed her as they stood before the fire, as if she were a girl. Now, John had found plenty of hard times, but luck had come at last. He had struck luck, and this was the end of a great year.
"No, I couldn't seem to write letters. No use to complain of the worst. And I wanted to tell you the best when I came."
And he told it while she cooked the supper.
"No, I wasn't going to write no foolish letters," John repeated.
He was afraid he should cry himself when he found out how bad things had been. And they sat down to supper together, just as they used to do when he was a homeless orphan boy who nobody else wanted in winter weather while he was crippled
and could not work. She could not be kinder now than she was then. Oh, but she looked so poor and old. He saw her taste her cup of tea and set it down again with trembling hand and a look at him. No, I wanted to come myself, he blustered, wiping his eyes and trying to laugh. And you're going to have everything you need to make you comfortable as long as you live, Mother Rob. She looked at him again and nodded, but she did not even try to speak. There was a good hot supper ready, and a happy guest had come, and, well, it was the night before Thanksgiving. And now, written by Lindsay McVeigh for the Smithsonian Magazine in November of 2017, Wampanoag Indian Thanksgiving Story. The Thanksgiving story you know and the one I know are most likely the same. It's the story deeply rooted in America's curriculum, the one that inspires, arguably, the most important and tradition-filled holiday in American culture. We're taught that in 1620, the Pilgrims fled harsh religious suppression in Britain, sailed across the Atlantic, and in December stepped ashore at Plymouth Rock, in what is now Massachusetts. With little food and no shelter, the colonists struggled to survive a brutal winter until a friendly Indian, Squanto, came along and showed them how to cultivate crops. Their first harvest resulted in a feast as the Pilgrims gave thanks to the kind Indians for helping to bring the colony back to life. This version of Thanksgiving, while pleasant, isn't terribly accurate. Told from a perspective that frames the Pilgrims as the main characters, the story leaves out major details, glorifying the Pilgrims' endeavor. And the holiday it birthed? True. But it was forcing the Wampanoag Indians into forgotten roles. It also erases a monumentally sad history. When we pay homage to the Pilgrims and their bravery and react to the tragic background of America's founding myth with silence, we essentially support a mindset that only some people's history matters. The true history of Thanksgiving begins with the Indians. About 4 years before the Pilgrims anchored off Massachusetts, British fishermen had already started making their way through New England, storming through Indian towns to kidnap native people for profit in the slave trade. Although it's often left out of textbooks, this series of intrusions was the catalyst to what is probably the most important event in this nation's history, without which Europeans would not have been able to settle on top of the millions of native people who already lived in America, at least not as fast. Epidemic, illness. Before 1492,
the Western Hemisphere was largely isolated, sparing its indigenous peoples from diseases the rest of the world succumbed to time and time again. But this lack of contact prevented natives of the Americas from developing any type of immunity to European, Asian, and African pathogens. When Europeans started trekking through Indian towns, they brought sickness with them. Indians died at an alarming rate, making it substantially easier for colonists to overpower entire villages. Well, what was left of them. The pilgrims already believed they were part of God's plan. Finding empty villages as 90%, oh yes, 90% of America's Indians perished in front of them, only furthered Europeans' sense of their destiny, influencing them to continue the colonization westward. As Jolene Rickard, Tuscarora, and Paul Chat Smith, Comanche, wrote in Our Peoples, Giving Voice to Our Histories, one of the opening exhibitions at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. That initial explosion of death is one of the greatest tragedies in human history because it was unintended and unavoidable and even inevitable. But what happened in its wake was not. One people who famously suffered from the onslaught of disease were the Wampanoag, a nation made up of 69 villages scattered throughout present-day Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Skilled hunters, gatherers, farmers, and fishers during spring and summer, the Wampanoag moved inland to more protected shelter during the colder months of the year. Like indigenous groups everywhere, the Wampanoag had a reciprocal relationship with nature and believed that as long as they gave thanks to the bountiful world, it would give back to them. Long before the arrival of the pilgrims, the Wampanoag held frequent Thanksgiving-like celebrations, giving thanks in the form of feasts and ceremonial games. Exposed to new diseases, the Wampanoag lost entire villages. Only a fraction of their nation survived. By the time the pilgrim ships landed in 1620, the remaining Wampanoag were struggling to fend off the Narragansett, a nearby native people who were less affected by the plague and now drastically outnumbered them. So, for a moment of history, the interests of the pilgrims and the Wampanoag aligned. When the pilgrims landed in New England, after failing to make their way to the milder mouth of the Hudson, they had little food and no knowledge of the new land. The Wampanoag suggested a mutually beneficial relationship in which the pilgrims would exchange European weaponry to Wampanoag for food. With the help of an English-speaking Patuxet Indian named Tisquantum, no, not Squanto, he spoke English because he was kidnapped and sold in the European slave trade before making his way back to America. The pilgrims produced a bountiful supply of food that summer. For their part, the Wampanoag were able to defend themselves against the Narragansett. The feast of indigenous foods that took place in October 1621, after the harvest, was one of thanks. But it more notably symbolized the rare, peaceful coexistence of these two groups. Next week, we'll bring you another article from Smithsonian Magazine, this one entitled, Do American Indians Celebrate Thanksgiving? So until then, good night.